In 2016, Clint Bolick became an associate justice on the Arizona State Supreme Court, making him one of the most influential libertarians in today's legal world. That appointment is merely the most recent career highlight for the 61-year-old activist, author, and policy wonk. In 1991, Bolick and Chip Mellor co-founded the Institute for Justice, the country's premier libertarian public interest law firm. In 2007, he became vice president for litigation at the Goldwater Institute, Arizona's leading free market think tank, where he took on restrictive licensing, zoning, and business regulations, and became a nemesis to Joe Arpaio, the self-proclaimed toughest sheriff in America. I sat down with Bolick in Phoenix to talk about his legal philosophy, the politics of immigration, and why he sports a tattoo on his typing finger. But I started out by asking him to discuss one of the most interesting cases to come before the high court during his tenure, which involved warrantless GPS searches.
This case involved putting a tracking device on a truck, and basically the police were following it for several days before they finally stopped it and, of course, made a drug arrest. We ruled 4-3 that a warrant was required. I voted in the majority on that. And then we voted 5-2 that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule applied to allow the warrantless search in that case. I joined the Chief Justice in dissenting from that.
Why do you think a warrant is necessary for police to do this?
The warrant requirement is really the last protection between between an individual's rights and tyranny. They're easier to get than ever before. You can get one in a matter of minutes if it's justified. And I think that our framers, by putting this in the Bill of Rights, really believed that before someone's individual rights, their privacy is violated, in most instances, you ought to get a warrant.
How did people, or why did your fellow justices rule this was, you know, covered by an exclusionary exemption?
We had to interpret federal Supreme Court law that is mystifying. For example, we are asked by the U.S. Supreme Court to determine whether the privacy interest involved is one that society is prepared to accept. That comes from a decision from in the middle of the last century. How's a judge supposed to know what society is prepared to accept? And what if that changes tomorrow? It really was a matter of seven justices trying in good faith to figure out Supreme Court law.
We've got to talk about that tattoo. Can you hold this up?
Sure.
You're the only inked member, as far as you know, of the Supreme Court of Arizona.
That's right.
That's a tattoo of a scorpion.
Yes.
Why do you have that on your finger?
So, one thing about public interest lawyers, and I know anyone who's done those kinds of cases will identify with this, you really get into the cases. And I, at the Goldwater Institute, I took on the cause of a tattoo artist who had a very successful studio in Mesa and wanted to open one in the college town of Tempe, Arizona. Invested $25,000, and this was during the recession, in a an abandoned store in a strip mall, obtained a use permit from the city of Tempe, and started his business. Lo and behold, the neighbors decide they'd much rather have a Starbucks. Of course, Starbucks was not planning to come there. So they went to the city council, which actually repealed the use permit. And suddenly, these folks were saddled with this lease and a lot of lost investment. I read about this on a Saturday afternoon, called the tattoo owners, and I said, would you like to fight this in court? And they said, we can't afford a lawyer. And I said, what I always love to say as a public interest lawyer, we're free. Along the way, and this case went all the way up to the Arizona Supreme Court years before I was on it, I said, you know what? If we win, I'm going to get inked. And sure enough, we did win, and I did get inked. And I have typed everything I have ever written, every Reason article, every book, every brief, with one finger. I don't even use two. So I decided that I would get a a tattoo on my typing finger, and that it would be a scorpion, which is a little desert creature with a powerful sting.
In terms of judicial philosophy, you've described yourself as a textualist. What does that mean, and how does that match up with, say, an originalist or a other kind of legal theory?
So textualism, I think, is a branch of originalism. But what textualism does is to rely on the meaning of the terms of the Constitution or a statute to the maximum possible extent. And often, if they're old words, then we look at what the meaning of those words were at the time they were adopted, using dictionaries and other sources. And then to apply the principles that those words represent to contemporary reality. So an originalist who is not necessarily a textualist tries to find original intent. And I think that that is much more subjective, because you can often find people on different sides. Just to give you an example, the gun rights cases that went to the U.S. Supreme Court were very originalist in their orientation, and you had very strong arguments on both sides of that debate. But a textualist will follow the words. And another thing about a textualist is that every word is given meaning. So, for example, we have no ink blots in the Constitution, as Robert Bork was famous for saying. To give you a tangible example of the difference between a textualist and an originalist might have decided Brown versus Board of Education differently, because an originalist would have looked back at the time of the 14th Amendment and found that lawful segregation was ubiquitous. And therefore, how could the framers have intended for the Equal Protection Clause to outlaw segregation? A textualist will look at the Equal Protection Clause and say, well, it means what it says. And whatever the framers of that amendment meant by it, or whatever they did that might have contradicted that principle, you apply the principle of equal protection.
Arizona is one of the states most enmeshed in political and cultural debates about immigration. In 2014, Bolick and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush co-authored Immigration Wars, which argued for a complete overhaul of existing laws in a way that is both pro-immigrant and pro-economic growth.
One thing that a lot of people do not realize is that alone among industrialized nations on the earth, our immigration system since the 1960s has been primarily a family-based immigration system, not an economics-based system. The definition of family has expanded so dramatically that it's really the driving force behind most immigration. If we were designing a system from scratch, I don't think it would be that way. We would want high-skilled workers. We would want workers to fill jobs at the lower ends of the economic system.
But would we also only see immigration as a function of needs of the economy, real or presumed? Or would it also be that individuals who don't necessarily have a relative here, you know, that they have a shot of coming here?
That's absolutely right. And one of the many aspects that we took on in the book, we both passionately believe in immigration. We are truly a nation of immigrants. And one of the things that's disappeared over the years, so many of the opponents of immigration today argue, why don't these people just get in line? And one of the things we pointed out, and this is perhaps the most important point that we made in the book, there is no line. If you do not fit into one of the handful of visa categories, if you are not a relative of someone living here, the only line is what's called a diversity lottery, which hundreds of thousands of people apply for every year. Your odds of getting it are virtually zero. If there was a line for people to get into, they wouldn't necessarily have to break the law to come here.
So how do you feel about, on the one hand, there are a number of Republicans, particularly in the Senate, who are pushing legislation that would almost have or cut in half legal immigration. And, you know, and then they say, we're going to, of course, secure the border, so there'll be no more illegal immigration, there'll be half as much legal immigration. But then also Donald Trump recently has started talking about skills-based immigration, and that he's done such wonders in the economy that now we need more workers than ever. Where do you see the immigration debate playing out, or how
well,
do you see it playing
out? It's an issue where there is a tremendous amount of consensus among ordinary people and almost none in the political parties. It's so frustrating. But the idea of having our immigration, Milton Friedman once famously said that you can't have a welfare state and have open borders. The flip side is probably also true. You can't have a welfare state and not enough people to support it. Our population is ultimately in decline. We just don't have young people. We either have to import people or we have to export jobs. And right now we are actually exporting more jobs than we're importing people. So we cannot find ourselves in a situation where we're reducing legal immigration. Trump, of course, as a businessman, has thrived from immigration. And every now and then you see indications that he understands the policy. Are there enough Republicans and Democrats who could make common cause, you know, eliminating family-based immigration? Was something that the so-called Gang of Eight agreed to, or reducing it, I should say. And there are commonalities. I think legalizing all of the DACA individuals would be another part of that compromise solution. Well, I think we can get there. And if Richard Nixon could open up China, so potentially could Donald Trump open up immigration.
One of the great nemeses in your career, particularly in its Arizona phase, was Sheriff Joe Arpaio. What do you think was driving him in terms of immigration? And I mean, he ultimately ran afoul of various court orders to stop doing what he was doing regarding, you know, harassing immigrants. What drives somebody like him?
You know, I've never been a very good amateur psychologist. I know that Sheriff Joe loved the limelight, and certainly immigration brought him into the limelight. If you look at his early years, he was the furthest thing from a militant on immigration issues. Quite the contrary, he said we should not prioritize tiny little crimes just because immigrants are committing them. And then, in fact, a lot of people don't remember, he endorsed Democrat Janet Napolitano for governor. But then he made a really hard turn, and I really am at a tremendous loss to explain it. But it came to the point where it was a diversion of resources from much worse crimes that were being committed, and he was found to have violated a number of federal immigration laws.
You guys still exchange Christmas cards, though, right? I hope.
It's funny. He is one of the most charismatic guys you could meet. And whenever we do see each other, he could not be a more pleasant person.
Well, now that you're on the Supreme Court, he knows he's going to be in front of
you. It is funny. The day I took office, we happened to be at the Capitol together for the governor's State of the State, and there was a line for food that he was in, and I was standing off to the side, and he walked by me, and he does a double take, and he says, "Anything that happened before today is history."
Where many libertarians are content with going after the federal government, Bullock has long warned against what he calls grassroots tyranny. In a 1993 book of that title, Bullock argued that petty local bureaucrats were often quicker to stomp on individual rights than D.C. lawmakers.
This is something that had occurred to the framers. If you read the Federalist Papers, Madison was very concerned that the smaller the government, the easier it is for special interest groups, or factions, as he called them then, to gain control and to execute what he referred to as their schemes of oppression. And I think that we do see that, where especially low turnout elections and special interest groups that really dominate a lot of local governments, they do engage in behavior that violates other people's rights. So I think that really those books were a clarion call. We focus on the national government all the time, and we we often ignore the threats in our own backyard. Who has more control over your day-to-day lives, right? Your city council or the president of the United States? It's your city council. It's your school board.
So it really the solution is to be kind of limited government or libertarian all the way down, or to push for that.
Oh, absolutely. And to get engaged, you know, just as it's easy for the bad guys to control local government, so is it easy for the good guys to be very influential at the local level, and I rarely see that kind of activism.
How do you, when you think about the Institute for Justice, which a lot of the cases were at the local or the state level, things like occupational licensing, zoning restrictions, weird, you know, attempts to screw people over, you know, at a lower level of government. When you look back on that now, how do you feel about the influence that the Institute for Justice has had?
I don't think when Chip and I came up with this idea in his backyard in Denver, if we had sat there and said, "What are your wildest dreams about this?" Whatever we would have said, IJ has exceeded those wildest dreams. We started with a staff of 7. After our first 3 years, one of our donors described us as the best law firm that's never won a case. And it took a while to gain traction. And now, IJ is one of the most significant legal organizations in the country, winning U.S. Supreme Court cases on a regular basis. I couldn't be more proud.
Yeah, and also, I mean, just injecting a set of ideas into public discussion,
yes,
even in the cases that you lose.
Yeah, and that's right, the Kelo case being the preeminent example.
Do you think Arizona is becoming more free? And when you step outside of Arizona, is it becoming more free in terms of economic freedom, cultural freedom, civil liberties? Are we headed in the right direction, or are we treading water, or are we going backwards?
You know, it's really hard to say. On the one hand, the threats to freedom of speech are I think, worse than at any time in my lifetime. And we just don't see people value freedom of speech as much as we once did.
What do you think explains that?
I think that we are dividing more than ever before into warring camps, and it's an ends justifies the means kind of philosophy. I teach constitutional law as an adjunct professor at ASU, and the first day of class I say, I want you to develop a set of neutral principles that you will apply in all circumstances. If people did that, I think we'd be much better off. But that's not happening today. And that's really, really disturbing. On the flip side, you do see some real progress for economic liberty. Both the left and the right seem to value entrepreneurship, small businesses. Arizona recently became the first state to adopt an Economic Liberty Act that I designed many, many years ago, but it wasn't until I was on the court that it was adopted. And it flips the presumption. Instead of a plaintiff who challenges a barrier to enterprise bearing the burden of showing that there's no rational basis, the government now has the burden of showing the rational basis.
How do you feel about civil liberties? However you want to construe that, do you think we're, is the government being forced to be more respectful of people's rights, or is that something that's always kind of a no man's land battle that's just kind of going back and forth?
It really is. The pendulum swings back and forth, and like the GPS case that I mentioned, so many of those cases are 4-3. And again, even at the grassroots level, you have people totally willing to violate other people's civil liberties and insisting that their own be recognized. This is where I think that libertarians can play a very, very significant role, and that is to show that if your free speech rights are violated, my free speech rights are violated. If your due process rights are violated, so are mine. That we have a universality when it comes to the protection of rights. And frankly, there's no one else in the society right now that I think has neutral principles that they will apply in all instances.
Do you enjoy being a Supreme Court justice?
I absolutely love it. You know, I loved being a litigator. But at this stage of my career, I have lots of people I've trained and mentored over the years who are doing the litigation stuff. And I love bringing my experience to bear and working with six other people who are extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily well-meaning to reach, in many instances, a collegial decision.